This is experthr.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for experthr.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. In this podcast, our attention turns to the thorny area of whistleblower law and how it's impacting employers. In early March, the Supreme Court expanded protections for employees who blow the whistle on alleged corporate misdeeds. The case of Lawson versus FMR extends the reach of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and makes it easier for certain segments of the workforce to come forward by safeguarding them from retaliation. But will this ruling open the floodgates to a wave of whistleblower lawsuits, or are those concerns overblown? We'll look at those issues and more with my colleague, Marta Moakley, who has been reporting on the Lawson case for us and covers employee management issues on the website. So we'll pick her brain about the Supreme Court's opinion, plus other related issues, including what to do when an employee blows the whistle on perceived wrongdoing. Prior to joining Expert HR, Marta worked as an assistant attorney general with the Florida Attorney General's office and is an equal opportunity specialist for the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. Marta, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, David. It's a real pleasure.
Well, a lot of employers were following the Lawson case with interest. Tell us what that one's about.
Lawson deals with the issue of which individuals are protected under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. It's basically the Act's whistleblower provision that was being studied by the court. In this case, it involves two former Fidelity Investment employees. We'll use FMR for short because there were actually various entities involved. And these employees claimed that they were retaliated against for blowing the whistle on unethical business practices. One employee had worked for FMR for 14 years and had actually been promoted to the position of Senior Director of Finance. The other employee had worked for Fidelity for 8 years as a portfolio manager for several mutual funds. Now, their employer is a private company that contracts with the mutual fund company itself to handle the fund's day-to-day operations, including making investment decisions or even filing reports with the SEC. As is common in this type of industry, the mutual fund company itself, which is the public company, has no employees. So the employees claim that they were constructively discharged or fired for raising concerns regarding some accounting irregularities and inaccuracies in an SEC registration statement. They were very upset by this. They filed claims with the Department of Labor's Whistleblower Protection Program, which is administered by the OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And then they filed their claims in federal district court after following whatever administrative procedures they had to with the DOL. The district court actually sided with them. However, the employer then appealed to the First Circuit Court of Appeals, arguing that the Sarbanes-Oxley whistleblower provision only applies to employees of public companies. At this point, the First Circuit actually sided with the employer. So the employees then petitioned the Supreme Court for review. And as we all know, the Supreme Court sided with the employees and ruled that any employee of private companies who contract with public companies are protected from retaliation for whistleblowing. And this decision definitely allows for an expansive interpretation of the definition of a protected class under the Act's whistleblower provision.
The Supreme Court's ruling was 6-3, with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg authoring the opinion. What was the majority's reasoning, Marta, in siding with the whistleblowers?
Justice Ginsburg put the question before the court in this manner. Does the SOX whistleblower provision, and I tend to call it SOX, shield only those employed by the public company itself, or does it shield as well employees of privately held contractors and subcontractors, for example, investment advisors, who perform work for the public company? The court answered yes and provided multiple reasons why. First and foremost, the majority read the plain text of the statute to support their reasoning. No public company or any officer, employee, contractor, subcontractor, or agent of such company may discharge, demote, suspend, threaten, harass, or in any other manner discriminate against an employee in the terms and conditions of employment because of whistleblowing or other protected activity. So The majority felt that this was very clear language through the plain text of the statute that contractors and subcontractor employees are covered as whistleblowers. But they looked further. They looked for a similar interpretation of a similar provision that is also enforced by OSHA. This is the AIR 21 Act. OSHA actually enforces 22 whistleblower statutes. Only one of them is SOX. There's also this AIR 21 Act. There's Transportation Acts. There's Food Safety Acts. So there are many that come under the umbrella. And that this particular provision, AIR 21, had also been read to cover employees of contractors and subcontractors. And third, the majority also cited to the congressional intent, the legislative history, when this act was passed.
Well, in the employee's appeal, they said a ruling for the employer would reimpose the same code of silence that allowed massive frauds such as Enron to occur. How big of a factor do you think that was in the court's decision here?
Yeah, well, I will say, David, that based on oral arguments and the way that they flowed, it really loomed large in the court's reasoning. This is the first time that the High Court has interpreted the Act's whistleblower provision, and many court experts had noted the specter of Enron throughout this case's travels to the High Court. The business practices leading to Enron's collapse involved a public company that used satellite shell companies to hide business losses, and then engaged the work of contractors, including lawyers and accountants, to shield that information from shareholders. At the same at that time, those who came forward did not have any recourse in the law to shield them from retaliation. However, many accountants and lawyers failed to come forward even to a supervisor, even within the organization, because of a code of silence that pervaded the Enron culture. And you can see the justices, you know, in this Lawson case, they see some parallels. This is a public company which has no employees of its own. And they believe that under these circumstances, the only employees with the knowledge to blow the whistle on questionable accounting practices or truly wholesale shareholder fraud would be the employees of a private company contract. Otherwise, the Enron scenario could be replicated again and again in the mutual fund industry and elsewhere. And I think even the way that Justice Ginsburg framed the argument brings the Enron scandal to mind. In posing the question, does the SOX whistleblower provision shield privately held contractors and subcontractors, she used as examples lawyers and accountants, which are examples from the Enron case, not from the Lawson case.
Yeah, this Lawson case is fascinating because you have a publicly held company with no employees. But I've read where some lawyers' groups representing employers have warned that this ruling from the Supreme Court extends Sarbanes-Oxley from covering roughly 5,000 companies to several million, including small businesses, and that this could lead to a lot more employment litigation. What's your take?
Approximately 5,000 companies, let's say, are regulated by the SEC. But there are potentially 6 million private companies who may contract with those public companies. Now, the real number is probably the hundreds of thousands right now that actually contract with public companies, but the potential is there. And when you look at, when you take into account subcontractors as well, it could involve mom and pop shops. So under this case, if you're a mom and pop shop, your employees may have protections under a statute that primarily protects fraud on shareholders of a publicly traded corporation. And the fraud that can be invoked, it's not limited to shareholder fraud. It could be mail, bank, or wire fraud. So does this sound like an expansive interpretation opening the door to the plaintiff's bar? Many employer groups, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in its friend of the court brief, truly believe so. And look, the reality is it is an expansive interpretation, but it's one that has been used by the Department of Labor for nearly a decade in processing complaints through the administrative channels. So although the process has been in place for some time, we could still see a flood of litigation. It's really difficult to predict. At this point, what we absolutely know is that it is a very employee-friendly decision on the part of the Supreme Court, and one that did not specifically include limits on the meaning of employee or the meaning of contractor.
The dissent in this case seemed to think this was a stunning overreach and suggested it could lead to, say, a babysitter bringing a federal case against his or her employer. in the case of a parent who works for a local company that's public, such as a Walmart, and all sorts of other sky is falling examples, ranging from household employees to lawyers. Tell us a little bit about the dissent's argument.
You know, what's interesting is that the majority read the plain text of the whistleblower provision that I just went over, and the dissent did the same, and they came to completely different conclusions. Why? Because the dissent also read the provision's title. The title is Protection for Employees of Publicly Traded Companies Who Provide Evidence of Fraud. Now, the dissent argues that despite this clear marker of intent, the majority has chosen to apply the provision to private contractors and subcontractors of public companies. So basically, what the majority has done is ostensibly changed the title to Protection for Employees of Publicly Traded Companies and Their Contractors and Subcontractors Who Provide Evidence of Fraud. But the dissent argues that the majority didn't stop there. Again, we're talking about the stunning reach of this decision. Instead of limiting the provision's reach, the dissent argues that the majority actually left the door open for contractors of public company executives, such as a nanny or a gardener, to enjoy the protections of the SOX whistleblower provision. So if you'll indulge me once more with the title, the majority has now changed the title to Protection for Employees of Publicly Traded Companies and Their Contractors and Subcontractors and Any Contractors of Public Company Employees Who Provide Evidence of Fraud. Now, again, we're talking about different instances of fraud. So under this expansive interpretation, even credit card fraud could conceivably merit whistleblower protection. So because so many interpretations are possible, this is a deeply ambiguous provision in the statute and should have been read in a different manner, in a limited manner, so as not to reach this absurd result. Now, the majority responds somewhat pithily that, you know, the fears are unfounded, and even if they come true, that Congress can easily take care of the problem by explicitly removing these employees from the provision's reach.
That title certainly sounds like a mouthful.
It is. I apologize.
There was a George Clooney movie a few years back, Up in the Air, in which Clooney played a contractor who traveled all over the country with the sole purpose of bearing the bad news to employees that they'd been fired. That movie made its way into this opinion, and it's not often we can work George Clooney and Justice Ginsburg into the same podcast, but we just did. Marta, tell us a little bit about how that came up.
All right. Well, not a complete expert on George Clooney up in the air. How this came up is the employer was urging that the meaning of contractor in the whistleblower provision be limited to the kind of character that George Clooney played. So we're talking about, and I quote, an axe-wielding specialist who would swoop in and do all of the retaliatory dirty work for the public company. Namely, they would have swooped in to FMR and fired the, you know, the 14-year veteran for raising some questions. Basically, this would be the contractor retaliating against the employees of the public company. And this, the employer argued, this is what this provision contemplated when the words contractor, subcontractor were used. The majority felt that the public company wouldn't be able to avoid liability in this kind of scenario with the axe-wielding specialist. Why? Because, you know, there are agency principles that exist in the law that the employer would have to answer for the actions of its agent. Basically, this axe-wielding specialist isn't making the decision. He's just the messenger. He's just bringing bad news and is really taking no part in the retaliation itself. The majority reason that to hold otherwise would so limit the definition of contractor that it would frustrate congressional intent. And, you know, in that case, perhaps bad actors would be able to run schemes that would defraud shareholders in as grand a scale as an Ocean's 11 movie, perhaps. Huh. I don't know.
Not to mention Ocean's 12 or 13.
Or 13, yes. Yes, the sequels.
Well, only a very small fraction of cases ever make it to the Supreme Court, Marta, and many don't make it to the courtroom, period. Have there been any other notable whistleblower settlements in this area?
The interesting settlements have come about, and I think it bears mentioning, the offices, the so-called offices of the whistleblower, which provide an incentive for whistleblowers to come forward with information. In 2010, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act was amended by Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank actually called for such a creation of an office of a whistleblower, both at the SEC and the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Now, again, under the bounty program, a whistleblower who provides original information, so it can't be something that's been reported or that they heard, you know, through the grapevine, mm-hmm. to the SEC that leads to a recovery exceeding $1 million, it then becomes entitled to 10 to 30% of any amount recovered. So as you can imagine, where you have a substantial recovery, 10 to 30% could be a nice number. However, there has only been one notable payout. It happened last October. Again, this has only been in existence since 2011. So it happened last October when it was a payout of $14 million to a whistleblower. The IRS does have a similar program. And as some of you may know, Bradley Birkenfeld, a former banker, received $104 million for blowing the whistle on UBS's offshore accounts. Now, that is a splashy case, but the program itself has come under attack by Senator Grassley, who's a champion of whistleblowers, as not being very effective. So again, these claims tend to fizzle. Where claims are really taking off, having to do with whistleblowers, is under the nation's oldest whistleblower statute, which is the Federal False Claims Act. And that is a Civil War era statute that was actually amended in 2009. And again, followers of Lawson will find this interesting, that it was amended to include contractor or agent in addition to employee in defining who may file a lawsuit. There has been a steady flow of cases since this amendment. The Department of Justice has been very adept at using this particular statute for their enforcement efforts. And I will tell you, some employment attorneys at some of Expert HR's author firms have confirmed that some of their clients have been bankrupted by some of these lawsuits. A recent example of a huge bounty isn't hard to find. A federal district court in Manhattan just approved a $63.9 million payout to a whistleblower who gave relevant information regarding J.P. Morgan's settlement with the government. The bank had agreed to pay $614 million to settle claims that it had financed basically bad mortgage loans through the Federal Housing Administration and the Veterans Administration. But if your company isn't involved in financial services, that doesn't mean that you can breathe any easier. Again, employers involved in healthcare or federal contractors have been particularly affected by the enforcement efforts in this area. And the latest numbers from the Department of Justice's HEAT initiative, that stands for Healthcare Fraud Prevention and Enforcement Action Team, I believe, which was announced in May 2009 and is conducted in partnership with the Department of Health and Human Services, has actually amassed a total of $19 billion through False Claims Act cases, with more than $13.4 billion of that amount recovered in cases involving fraud against federal health care plans.
Whistleblowers can be absolutely critical in certain instances in helping employers to operate more effectively. So what's the first step if an employee comes forward with an internal complaint to HR?
I think it's really important to thank the individual for coming forward and to really thank them for any information that they may provide. The first response that an employer receives when coming forward with information may set the tone for their entire perception of the employer, of the compliance program, of just the culture. And it will really dictate any next steps that they take, if any. An employee who comes forward has probably thought about it long and hard. And if the organization does not have a hotline where the complaints may be lodged more or less anonymously and the employee has gone to a supervisor, then that employee has probably thought about the consequences even longer. Many whistleblower advocates put forth that instead of, you know, derogatory terms that we've all heard, such as, you know, snitch or tattletale or rat, you know, mm-hmm. those who blow the whistle on corporate misdeeds should be praised as truth tellers. And this may very well be the case. Ideally, the first person to take a whistleblower complaint is well-versed in the organization's internal compliance program, including the implementation of any processes specifically focused on minimizing the risk of external whistleblowing that is going to an agency if they're not satisfied with the response, and really developing and keeping adequate documentation if litigation is unavoidable. If they know this person is not happy, they're going to go and file a claim anyway. However, HR and any other employer representatives should be wary of making any promises at this point to whistleblowers. They shouldn't be, you know, guaranteeing how long an investigation will take or who will be spoken to or how much they will be able to disclose about any action taken or specifying that there will be an action taken. You know, but having said that, keeping the lines of communication open with the whistleblower, again, just really feeds into a collaborative culture and an ethical culture.
So communication really is key here.
I think so. It's important also to recognize that whatever information the whistleblower is bringing forth, it may have an impact on the organization. Maybe they're having a problem or they're perceiving a problem because there are rules being broken, or maybe procedures aren't clear. Maybe it's a training opportunity. Maybe it's a learning opportunity. It doesn't have to be this dire situation where a huge lawsuit will occur if, again, you know, the adequate steps are taken by the employer.
Again, our guest is expert HR legal editor Marta Moakley. Marta, is there anything special that supervisors need to know about how to deal with an employee who engages in whistleblowing activities?
Well, I think first and foremost, a supervisor needs to identify whistleblowing because they may not think that something is actually whistleblowing when it is. So basically, a complaint from an employee about an activity or practice at the organization that may be illegal or fraudulent, that could be whistleblowing. Now, if it's a personal gripe, it probably isn't, but again, an opportunity to talk to the employee to delve deeper into what is happening. Supervisors also need to know the procedures. You know, if you're a publicly traded company, if you're a public company, then there are very specific procedures that the SEC delineates. However, every organization, including private companies, should have a very good compliance program, internal compliance program. You should follow the process. You should include any other representatives of the organization. You should protect the whistleblower, and you should document the investigation of any at this point. Now, anyone may engage in an activity that is legally protected. Therefore, that opens the door for retaliation. So sometimes an employee becomes a whistleblower because he or she either complains about an illegal behavior or complains because they did something that was entirely legal, such as filing a workers' compensation claim, and then believe that they were retaliated against. Perhaps they received a demotion or a transfer or even just a poor performance appraisal, and they're upset about that. Again, at that time, that employee may begin to consider going to an enforcement agency to enforce their rights. So it's important to troubleshoot and problem solve. So having said that, there are instances, and many employment attorneys know of these instances, where the whistleblower is not just talking about a specific complaint, but may fit a certain whistleblower type. One of the whistleblower types is actually one, the so-called private attorney general, and this is a do-gooder that seeks to right all workplace wrongs and will fight for the integrity of the workplace. Now, the problem here is that they may have the best of intentions, but they may not really have the pertinent facts or an adequate grasp of the law to make an informed decision about what is legal or illegal. And this type of whistleblower can be dangerous because this is somebody who may be prone to going to talk to the media about something that they believe has happened, or, of course, a plaintiff's attorney. Another whistleblower type known to employment attorneys is the whistleblower that may have something to hide. This employee probably has a checkered disciplinary record, probably doesn't get along with others, may have engaged in some misconduct relating to that which he is complaining about. So, you know, blowing the whistle on the employer may deflect some attention away from him or her. And let me tell you, the previous IRS whistleblower that we talked about, who was paid $104 million, he also served 2.5 years in prison for aiding a client evade taxes. So it's not necessarily a white hat situation, or, you know. Now, having said all of this, while whistleblowers are entitled to protections under the law for having complained, for taking these protected activities, a supervisor needs to know that they're not completely immune from discipline. But due to the sensitive nature of these claims, the employer should carefully investigate any perceived misconduct, be prudent in applying discipline, and particularly any discipline that comes shortly after an employee files a whistleblowing complaint. And of course, either contact your in-house or outside counsel before terminating an employee.
Marta, are there any other challenges employers must deal with when it comes to managing an employee who's blown the whistle on what they perceive to be unethical behavior at the company?
Yeah, I think that retaliation by coworkers or targets of an investigation should be an area of particular concern for employers. Unfortunately, this does occur, and an employer must ensure a safe workplace for all workers, whether they be whistleblowers, witnesses, or supervisors, ombudsmen. And again, retaliation can be harassment. It can be, you know, it really can deplete the productivity of a workplace. Also, you know, protecting the safety of a whistleblower should be taken into account when deciding to widen the scope of an investigation. As in any workplace practice, it's best to keep information from those without a need to know. So discretion is very, very important in these kinds of investigations. And ethics considerations are particularly important as well. Fostering a culture of integrity and truly abiding by ethical principles can provide the type of safe and productive environment that discourages the potential for, again, the external whistleblowing agencies coming in or federal lawsuits of the type that we saw in Lawson.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but Marta, are there any quick final thoughts before we let you go?
Well, I would like to mention that on March 4th, the White House did release its proposed budget, and whistleblower protection against employer retaliation has been highlighted as an enforcement priority. Specifically, the Department of Labor has announced that the budget request includes $565 million for OSHA to not only strengthen worker safety, but also to enforce, again, its 22 statutes through its whistleblower program. In addition, the White House budget also provides a total of $681 million for financial fraud enforcement. And this is relevant because the DOJ is very active in using the False Claims Act against employers. Again, there is activity also in the courts as well as in the political sphere. Dodd-Frank's whistleblower provisions have been the subject of vigorous court debate of late, and the circuits are very busy interpreting, one, the scope of coverage for protected activities, whether an employee must file a complaint with the SEC to get protection or whether they can just file an internal complaint, and also whether Dodd-Frank's whistleblower provision applies to laws or territories outside of the U.S. And many of these may result in the so-called circuit splits, where perhaps the Supreme Court steps in, or perhaps we'll see another whistleblower case interpreting the False Claims Act in the next year or so. Finally, I just flag that there is much activity at the state level as well. Even if a state does not enact a specific whistleblower statute, many statutes have retaliation protections. You know, for example, there was a New Jersey SAFE Act that was passed recently. There are right to request laws. These are right to request flexible working arrangements in San Francisco and Vermont, and they also have retaliation protections. And of course, California, you can bet that any new law will probably have retaliation protections. So it's very important to keep abreast of these state level developments in order to remain truly compliant.
Okay, well, we'll let that be the last word. Expert HR legal editor Marta Moakley has been my guest. Marta, it certainly sounds like there's a lot to watch when it comes to whistleblowing. Thanks for your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Continue checking our website regularly for more podcasts on key employment topics affecting the world of HR, including biometrics in the workplace and why paid leave laws are starting to proliferate.
The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR and our subscription offering, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. And if you mention listening to this podcast, we'll give you 20% off a new subscription. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.